Editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports Russia is drawing fresh condemnation after strikes at Kyiv's Children's Hospital.
Russian missiles blasted five cities across Ukraine Monday. Officials say at least 31 people were killed. Among the buildings hit, the Children's Hospital in Kyiv, forcing young cancer patients to take their treatments outdoors. The UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk called it abominable, noting these were Ukraine's sickest children. Ukraine's Air Force said it intercepted 30 of the more than 40 missiles fired, while Russia denied attacking the hospital and said the strikes hit military targets. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller.
These are sites that serve no military purpose.
The assault came on the eve of the NATO summit in Washington. I'm Ben Thomas.
Meanwhile, this VOA's Anita Powell previewing the summit tells us that as President Joe Biden welcomes members of the newly enlarged NATO alliance, some critics have put more focus on Biden's age and health.
On Monday, the 81-year-old Biden said he's staying in the presidential race amid a growing list of calls for him to step aside after his shaky debate performance last month. The White House on Monday refuted questions that NATO allies are concerned that these cracks at the leadership level could put the 75-year-old alliance on shaky ground as it leaves to Washington this week. John Kirby is White House National Security Communications Advisor.
We're not picking up any signs of that from our allies at all, quite the contrary. The conversations that we're having with them in advance is they're excited about this summit, they're excited about the possibilities and things that we're going to be doing together specifically to help Ukraine.
The alliance meets Tuesday in Washington. And call the news, the White House.
Meanwhile, Hamas has warned that Israel is expanding military operations in Gaza City, and the displacement of thousands of residents could have disastrous repercussions for talks aimed at a ceasefire. This is VOA News. The White House said on Monday it did not expect any change in Iran's behavior after the election of a relative moderate for president. National Security spokesperson John Kirby said during a briefing,
"We'll see what this guy wants to get done, but we are not expecting any changes in Iranian behavior."
Kirby also said that the United States, was not ready to resume nuclear talks with Iran under the new president because the country was still supporting groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, as well as the Houthis attacking ships in the Red Sea, and was still supplying drone technology to Russia. Now, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer continued his tour of the UK Monday as part of his pledge for an immediate reset with governments in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales. The new Prime Minister met with the First Minister of Wales, Fionn Fitzgerald, and said that there would be improved cooperation between Wales and Westminster under a Labour government, unlike what he described as conflict with the previous Conservative Party administration.
Here in Wales is particularly important because what I said before the election is that the Labour government would be a game changer because you have a UK government working with the Welsh government delivering for Wales rather than a conflict that I think we've seen too much of over the last 14 years.
After Hurricane Beryl slammed into the U.S. state of Texas, knocking out power to nearly 3 million homes and businesses and killing at least 3 people, it moved east and weakened to a tropical depression. Fast-moving tempest on Monday threatened to carve a harsh path over several more states in the coming days. Officials warned it could take several days to restore power, and Beryl came ashore as a Category 1 hurricane and toppled 10 transmission lines and knocked down trees that took power lines down. Beryl later weakened into a tropical storm and then a tropical depression. At first glance, elections in France and Britain were a triumph for leftists and reformers over authoritarian and the right. Even Iran, where Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said that the final say on the matters of state elected a heart surgeon, a long-term lawmaker associated with the reformist government. In France, the leftist coalition beat the far right into third place in legislative elections. The UK's center-left Labour Party swept back to power in the landslide after 14 years of conservative rule. Iranian voters opted for the more moderate of two candidates as well. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Russia expands its influence in Africa as three Sahel nations form an alliance.
There is the Wagner Group out of Russia that is now also part of the Russian Ministry of Defense, which is called the Africa Corps. They definitely have a presence on the continent, and that presence is growing.
Uganda's opposition calls for action on corruption. A Zambian bishop welcomes President Hichilema's promise to hold peace talks with his predecessor. Kenyan clerics call on President Ruto to dissolve his cabinet as anti-tax protests continue. Two groups involved with South Sudan's peace talks in Kenya say the discussions are at risk of collapse.
We are here to negotiate a new agreement that will include a rescue plan to rescue South Sudan, and that is why we are saying the government should not be taking decisions to take us back.
The U.S. President Joe Biden says he is staying in the race for his re-election. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Russia has expanded its influence in Africa in recent times by deepening ties in North Africa, the Sahel, and rekindling Cold War ties in Southern Africa. The military leaders of Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso broke away from the regional bloc ECOWAS over the weekend and formed their own defense alliance in the Sahel. Nola Hines, a political scientist at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, tells viewers Carol Van Damme that Russia typically relies on mercenaries to expand its reach on the continent.
There is, through the Wagner Group, which is a paramilitary mercenary group out of Russia that is now also part of the Russian Ministry of Defense, which is called the Africa Corps. They definitely have a presence on the continent, and that presence is growing. So in terms of Russia's footprint, it is done through their kind of mercenary groups. Just kind of when you think about 2014 in Crimea, a lot of the issues around Crimea was that Russia used insurgents to invade Crimea in 2014. They actually didn't take responsibility for that right away or in very kind of indirect ways. But today, sitting here in 2024, we know very clearly that it was, you know, insurgent mercenary type groups. We're seeing some of those things in the Sahel region, countries that are aligning more with Wagner in terms of arming different countries, different paramilitary groups, even that are African. Mm-hmm. Some instances, it's agitating terrorist organizations, so there's an uptick in global terrorism. So it is definitely a problem.
The Biden administration concerned that maybe this is why the Sahel junta leaders feel more confident about breaking away from ECOWAS, you know, the West African region bloc, because they say that they're going to form their own group now.
Right. Again, not speaking for the administration. I would say yes, because they feel emboldened. I mean, think about it this way. If you are a paramilitary organization in your country and this group is saying, hey, we will arm you to the teeth. You don't have to be in partnership with the United States who have all of these rules and regulations. You know, we will arm you without all of those rules and regulations. Now, obviously, they're not doing it for free. So there's something that Wagner and Russia is getting out of this relationship. I would wager a guess that it's more about having influence if the situation in Russia and Ukraine, if for whatever reason it goes beyond Ukraine. This is one of those situations where Russia definitely uses proxy states to do their dirty work. So in that regard, perhaps that's what the relationship is. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just guessing, looking at how previous relationships with other states in Russia have gone. But, you know, it's definitely something that is of concern. And definitely for the civilian populations, when I think about Sudan, when, you know, that's not talked about nearly enough. And the human rights crisis that's going on there is massive. So there's a huge civilian element to this, too, that I'm just incredibly worried about, that I don't think that Wagner gives two cares about.
Nola Hines is a professor at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme in Washington, D.C. The presiding bishop for the Pentecostal Assemblies of God has welcomed the promise by Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema to hold peace talks with his predecessor, former President Edgar Lungu. Bishop Joshua Banda says most people are optimistic that the peace talks could help ease political tensions in the country. His remarks come after President Hichilema said he has heard the advice of the church and promised to reach out to the former president for dialogue. For reaction, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Bishop Banda in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
This announcement from the president, this is as it should be, and we believe that this is a step in the right direction. A few weeks ago, where we were installing one of our bishops, and we were privileged to have her honor, the Vice President of the Republic of Zambia, as our guest of honor. We used that opportunity to call upon our leaders to see to it that they would be able to find ways of talking to one another. And the Vice President responded very positively to that.
So Bishop Banda, was the concern of the church and some organizations in Zambia that the political tension is as a result of the two gentlemen, the president and the former president, sharp disagreement or criticism of each other, the reason why political tension has risen in the country?
Our perspective is that that's not the only aspect. It's an important aspect, but that's not the only. There are various facets to this which have contributed to the build-up in the tension. So I would want to clarify that and say that, no, that's not the only. But it's an important and key facet, and that is why we welcome that portion of it. You know very well that to be able to pull the nation together, it takes more than just two individuals. And these two individuals, the president as incumbent and the former president, are very key in their standing. However, you know that there are many other functionaries and many other facets and stakeholders to the peace-building process.
As part of the peace process, yes. Bishop Banda, if these two leaders were to smoke the peace pipe, should they address the public jointly or issue a statement to decrease the tension?
That's a possibility. We can't be overly prescriptive as to what they should do as and when they meet. However, it would be desirable and it may be useful for some level of joint communique. They all have their parties that they have to keep in mind. But for the nation, that would be useful.
As the church and as Zambians as well, what are your expectations after the president made the promise to make this olive branch gesture to his colleague, the former president, to smoke the peace pipe?
Our expectations would be that when a high-level pronouncement is made like that, it's a directive, so we expect that the functionaries and those functionaries that are attached to the national processes, we expect that by now they're probably already in motion trying to see how best this could be done, and the sooner definitely the better.
That's Bishop Joshua Banda of Zambia. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Two groups involved with the so-called Tumaini peace talks taking place in Kenya have warned that the discussions are at risk of collapse. The talks between the South Sudan government and the armed group considered to be peace holdouts who have yet to sign the 2018 revitalized peace agreement. Pagan Amon Okech calls himself the leader of the Real Sudan People's Liberation Movement. He tells me that the government in Juba has taken three actions that, if not corrected, could doom the talks. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makui declined to comment, saying only that the government does not negotiate on social media.
These are disastrous decisions that they have made. One is that they have enacted a law that violates the fundamental basic rights of the people of South Sudan. It is a law that they have used for many years to impose a dictatorship, a totalitarian regime in the country And secondly, it is a law that is aimed at interfering in the political process in the country, denying the political parties that political space necessary for them to interact with the people and also hold accountable the government. This is a draconian law that must be immediately thrown out.
Let me ask you, they are the transitional government of national unity. Don't they have the right to make laws affecting the country?
They have the right to make laws that are respecting the fundamental rights of the people. They have the right to make law to institute the rule of law, not to violate the principle of rule of law. That act is giving power to arrest citizens without warrant of arrest. This is a law that is being used to deny the people of South Sudan their freedoms of expression, their freedom of assembly, their freedom of movement, and their right to hold their government accountable to them.
You talk about disastrous decisions that the parties have agreed to extend themselves in power for another 24 months.
Yes, that is a disaster because that would mean extending the suffering of the people of South Sudan for another 24 months. But guess what? They said that they only accomplished 10% of the RRCs, of their agreement that they signed, in 6 years. Meaning, for them to implement the whole agreement, they would want to extend themselves in power for 60 years. This is the worst disaster in terms of probably the saddest news for our people.
That's why every one of you were sent to Kenya to negotiate.
Exactly.
Yes. It seemed to me you also have a problem with the National Elections Commission scheduling elections in South Sudan by the end of this year. What is your concern? You said this is in bad faith?
Yes. We are here to negotiate a new agreement that will include a rescue plan to rescue South Sudan from the current situation, to rescue South Sudan and prevent it from collapsing into chaos and disorder and disintegration. That's why we are here. And that is why we are saying the government should negotiate in good faith. The government should not be taking decisions to take us back or to attempt to extend themselves in power or to try to violate the basic rights of our people on the elections. Even the parties to the agreement, the Artigono, have agreed that the elections in South Sudan will be held under a permanent democratic constitution where power will be entrenched in the hands of our people to elect their government periodically in free and fair elections. They have also agreed that the elections will be conducted after census have been made, after registration of voters have been made, after the demarcation of the constituencies have been made, and after the constitution has identified the political system in the country, which will also determine what type of a system we are going to have. All these prerequisites have not been met. How can you hold elections without a constitution? How can you hold elections when even the system of government is not agreed yet? This is an attempt to steal power, to steal legitimacy from the people.
Pagan Amon is the leading member of South Sudan's so-called peace holdout armed groups. He was speaking with us from Nairobi, Kenya. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 9th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The opposition in Uganda is calling on President Museveni to help prosecute corrupt officials. Federal officials say that those found guilty should reimburse their loot. Reporter Mugumi's David Rakariji has more from Kampala.
The Ugandan president recently shocked the nation when he said he has credible information on top of government officials involved in corruption scandals. Museveni said those involved in corruption include those working close with him at the State House. The president called them into court, traitors, and said his government will crush them.
I have been hearing that from Ministry of Finance, they arranged with the accounting officers of ministries to come to Parliament, working with some people there, to provide certain funds, provided you take a share. I didn't believe this, but now I have proof.
Now, Uganda's opposition say the president should stop the rhetoric and have those involved in corruption charged in courts of law. John Chikonyogo is the spokesperson for the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC.
That evidence must be given either to CID, and people answer, or IGG. Any of them can take these corrupt people to court. People, they should confiscate their property, and you get our money back. I think people of Uganda are more interested in that.
CID refers the Criminal Investigation Department, while IGG is the Inspectorate General of Government, police and public bodies responsible for investigating and prosecuting fraud in Uganda. Uganda is ranked 141st among the 180 countries in the 2023 Corruption Perception Index by Transparency International. Uganda loses at least 1 million Uganda shillings, or about $300 per hour, through corruption, according to the IGG. Marlon Agaba, who heads the Anti-Corruption Coalition of Uganda, agrees the president should put his words into action.
I've seen several scandals where only a few people are arrested and most of them walk away scot-free. So that doesn't show commitment. I think really to have some impact is that he needs to tackle the high level of corruption within his circles, within the cabinet, and within hierarchy government officials. Then I think that level of commitment would be able to trickle down to other high-ranking government officials.
Museveni has over the past established several bodies such as the State House Anti-Corruption Unit, State House Investor Protection Unit, State House Health Monitoring Unit, and others to beef up the already established government anti-corruption bodies in his bid to fight the problem. Last week, the president created another one known as the State House Revenue Intelligence and Strategic Operations Unit to provide oversight on revenues and taxes. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinjini, Kampala, Uganda.
Kenyan clerics are calling on the president to dissolve his cabinet as the protests against his administration and legislators continue. The Kenyan president has already withdrawn the 2024 financial bill, which was the catalyst of the demonstrations, but a section of Kenyan society, including the church, wants the government to clean up the governance system that many say is corrupt and captured by the executive branch.
Pressure is mounting on President William Ruto to overhaul his cabinet, who many blame for the country's debt and economic problems. The National Council of Churches of Kenya, which represents some of the country's biggest churches and religious organizations, has added its voice to protest, saying Ruto's administration is marred by bad governance and allegations of corruption. Council of Churches General Secretary Reverend Chris Kinyanjui called for Ruto to fire his ministers.
The president has himself said that his cabinet is incompetent. Kenyans are saying he has an incompetent cabinet.
Ruto's government recently proposed tax increases to offset the country's debt. The proposal sparked protests which killed at least 40 people and injured more than 380. Ruto withdrew the tax hikes after protesters stormed the parliament buildings, forcing legislators to flee. On Friday, Ruto announced new measures to reduce government expenditure, including merging key ministries and state corporations, banning the purchase of government vehicles for 12 months, and suspending non-essential travel by state and public officers. Kenyan political commentator Dismas Mukua notes that none of Ruto's cabinet members have been convicted on corruption charges and told VOA that Ruto will be reluctant to dismiss them.
So if the courts have not pronounced one guilty of anything, then the probability of President Ruto firing somebody from the cabinet merely on account of people demanding that he should be fired is almost zero. But the key consideration here is really the cost of living. If he's able to turn around the economy and ensure that the public debt is not a burden on the majority of Kenyans, then people will settle down and they'll wait for 2027.
Some protesters are also demanding the formation of a new independent electoral commission. Mukua says the demands of the Kenyan protests, which have been dubbed Generation Z protests, for the age of the organizers are far-reaching.
The pressure which is going to be applied by Gen Z is not going to be limited to the national governments. It will go down to county governments. It will go down to members of the National Assembly. It will go down to churches.
The Secretary General of Kenya's ruling party, United Democratic Alliance, Cleophas Malala, said the party will start a program of government outreach and engagement. He says political leaders must not always come to the people only when they want their votes. He says we also need to talk to people and listen. Some experts blame the recent protests on a lack of space for Kenyans to air their grievances. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. President Joe Biden says he is staying in the race for re-election against former President Donald Trump after Biden's struggle in their first debate. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at what U.S. voters think about the president's continuing candidacy.
The Biden campaign is pushing back against calls for their candidate to step aside following his debate struggles. With $50 million in paid media for July and an aggressive campaign schedule this week, Biden told a Wisconsin rally Friday that he's staying in the race. Voter Sabrina Jordan says he's still a viable candidate.
He should be consistent. He should be, I won't say defiant, but somewhere between consistent and defiant, he needs to let people know. And he did today that he ain't going nowhere. And unless something changes dramatically, he is the man for me.
Voter Jonathan Listag was not so sure.
The physiology that he displayed, he is not the same man. You can't turn back. We're not getting younger. You can't beat old age.
Seeing Biden back on the campaign trail after the debate does not ease the concerns of registered Democrat Ellis Johnston.
I don't feel confident in Joe Biden's ability to win this election, and that makes me very afraid.
For Trump supporters, Biden's sometimes halting debate performance reconfirmed their view that he's not fit for another term. California voter Lamont Pearson.
There's nothing that can come out of Joe Biden's mouth to make me think anything other than what he's already shown me, as well as Trump.
Biden's debate performance is not the whole picture, says Georgia voter Jeffrey Tannarelli.
I think Joe Biden is very passionate and very intelligent. I think he did not perform well because he did not meet the expectations, and his performance was what people expected of him.
That lack of energy leaves Washington, D.C. voter Hannah Sobolevich open to a new candidate.
It was kind of clear to me that maybe Biden's not as with it as he used to be, and I think I'd be supportive if someone, they put up another candidate rather than Biden.
If Democrats are to have a different nominee, they need to move quickly, says Michigan voter Alexis Zaidan.
There's a lot of conversations that need to happen within the next, you know, month around what could the Democratic Party do to bring all of its, you know, fractured vote, like its fractured base back to its core and hopefully build strong ahead of November, or we will be looking at a Trump presidency.
Biden's vice president and running mate Kamala Harris would be at the top of the list to replace him as the party's candidate. But that may not work, says California voter Stephanie Bowers.
Kamala would take over, which I would love, but I also think with the world being the way it is, all the prejudice going on, Trump would probably beat Kamala more so than beating Biden.
Pushing ahead with Biden as the nominee, his campaign has First Lady Jill Biden meeting with military families in three states this week, and the president counter-programming next week's Republican Party convention with remarks in Texas and Nevada. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that's it for this Tuesday, July 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.